and that's a, so he has a businessman's viewpoint, which may be considerably different from mine, but I think for the purposes of having a broad discussion, it would be well, either before or after the break that we may have pretty quick, to hear from George Cooper.
Well, sure, look forward to that then, Stan, that's good, and we will have a break after the next and final panelist, Frank Murkowski, who, as I mentioned earlier, was the Commissioner of Economic Development, and I'm sure is well known to all of you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to comment on two areas. One is just an observation on the non-discrimination portion of our Constitution, which provides for equal taxation. It appears that while the merits of equality are certainly the fair way to approach a situation like this, we do have some inequities that are occurring in our state because of it. We've seen in Anchorage as well as Fairbanks, outside groups come in and tie up large segments of our downtown areas for the purpose, very frankly, of speculation. And as a consequence, we've had no way of forcing development of some of these areas. It's not a real concern, perhaps, but it is taking place in various metropolitan areas of our state. Some states have a differential on taxation, resident versus non-resident. I believe some of them have a different rate of taxation as well. They tax at a higher millage improved property versus unimproved property. I'm not suggesting by any means that we change it, but we might watch that picture and put that on the list of things to consider if and when there is ever another constitutional convention, because it could theoretically get out of hand. As we're all aware of, we're very dependent on outside capital for the development in the state of Alaska, and we like, as Alaskans, to have some control over this destiny, and if large segments of our land are tied up for speculative purposes and we don't have the availability under our Constitution to treat the matter, why, we could have a real concern. As far as the permanent fund is concerned, I had the opportunity to take part in that lease sale in 1969, and the attitude that prevailed in Alaska was certainly one of a utopia, that we were on the road to riches, taxation was practically a thing of the past. And this is what the common man in the street was thinking: gee, $900 million, how could we possibly go through that? It looked like perhaps we'd get a relief from some of our ad valorem taxes. There was talk about elimination of the state income tax. And there was a good deal of consideration at that time to establishing a permanent fund. And various organizations in the state spoke in behalf of it. And it didn't happen, obviously. And money's gone. We're in a shortfall, as the Commissioner of Revenue has pointed out. And now it's before us again when we look at the oil royalties coming in from the pipeline. And it does work in some states. I believe Texas, through the Texas Railroad Commission, operates a permanent fund concept for their state universities. And they've had a devil of a time in as much as the legislature hasn't been able to touch that, and they'd like to get into it. But I believe the Texas universities program is quite successful, and it is the concept of the permanent fund in action. I feel that the application of the permanent fund is a sound one, based, if nothing else, on a matter of our past record in handling the movement of some $900 million. It's true we've got substantial capital improvements that have been made in the state during that period of time. We've also lost a great deal, and I don't think you could possibly estimate the amount that is taken from that $900 million in administrative expenses of the very nature of government in operation. It's very substantial, obviously. I would feel that the concept of a permanent fund, and I think Representative Cowper has already touched on it, of going back in and developing renewable resources, because once your non-renewable resources are gone, why, then what do you do? And we do have the potential for some very significant developments, as he mentioned, in agriculture, fish and timber. For that matter, tourism is a renewable resource. And I think we've got to perhaps go one step further, and I'm going to wind this up, but basically, can the permanent fund be applied in such a way through state intervention and utilization of this fund to most important curb inflation and perhaps lower the cost of living in the state of Alaska? I feel there's some ways this might be done. We're going to be one of the larger oil-producing, energy-producing states in the United States, yet we're looking at energy costs to ourselves as consumers substantially higher than our neighboring states that produce oil. Well, how do you get around that? There are ways. Perhaps the state could take a 20% less royalty in to the general fund with the provision that the refinery would reduce their price to the oil companies or the service companies 20%, so the consumer at the end would have a lower cost of energy. And I think that concept in the permanent fund, and it's pie in the sky at this point perhaps, but I think it has an application, because our track record really, in my opinion at least, speaks for itself in the necessity of a permanent fund, consequently a constitutional amendment. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Frank. I think we'll take a short break, but before we do, the permanent fund proposition, that when we talk about it for the next several hours, I'm sure we will, bear in mind a little bit the language. 25% of all mineral lease rentals, royalty sale proceeds, federal mineral revenue sharing payments, and bonuses received by the state would be paid into the fund. It doesn't include severance taxes, it's royalties. The principal of the fund would be used only for income-producing investments permitted by law. The income would be deposited in the general fund of the state and would be available for expenditure. Now, the principal of the fund would be used only for income-producing investments permitted by law. That's the heart of the suggested change. It passes as it speculated it would. I think the terminology income-producing investments will be one that receives a lot of public attention, and indeed perhaps wonderment. What was meant by income-producing investments permitted by law means that the next legislative session or the one following that will describe the method, manner, and means of making the investments, the income-producing investments. Now, the legislature could conceivably constitute itself the investing body. That possibility is remote, but it's a possibility. It has a number of other obvious options which you can speculate about. It also means, and I think importantly, although I favor the creation of a fund, we're talking about, as I say, something that's quite a unique step in Alaska, to segregate 25% of mineral royalties away from annual appropriation, away from legislative annual expenditure. We'll take just a short break and try and be back here in 5 minutes, and then we can start open discussion. We'll resume the session. I'm reminded that Mr. Cooper, who was a delegate, if you have any remarks you'd like to make, we'd be very pleased to hear them to flesh out what your colleagues have said.
All right, thank you. What I would like to address myself to is the not the fund. I did want to correct one statement that has been made here, and you indicated 25% as though that were a firm figure. That is not correct. This is a legal copy of this paper. It's at least 25%, and
right.
There's an awful difference there. However, During the Constitutional Convention, probably one of the most constantly referred to subjects was that we shall not, we must not legislate through the Constitution. And I'm afraid that what you have here is a question that's being put before the electorate of Alaska that should be divided, and it will have to be divided. The question is, will you amend the Constitution to allow dedication of funds? Period. That's the question you're talking about. Then, if you amend the Constitution, if the electorate amends the Constitution to allow for the dedication or earmarking of funds, then do you earmark a fund of at least 25% from royalties or licenses, etc., of your natural resources? Bear in mind that in at the way this is written now, in the future, any movement of the percentage figure or any addition of another source of funds will require another constitutional amendment. And that's the very thing that you have to protect yourself from. Do not legislate. Allow the legislation, the law, to be enforced by the legislature, which is at a much more closely responsive time to the people and the period of time that you're going through. Your Constitution, the present time, 20 years, getting close to a ballot, as a matter of fact, on another constitutional convention, but your people 10 years ago, the state didn't seem fit to call a constitutional convention. For the most part, because you have the freedom of legislation in here and not pinpoint specifically some problems out in the future. And that was the only area that I really wanted to address myself to, that I think that the proposition as it really exists is unconstitutional from the standpoint that it has not been divided. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Now the time has come for any member of the audience to ask a question, assert a position, and simply proceed to the microphone. I hope some of the things that have been said stimulate some query or argument. Simply come to the microphone and identify yourself, and we'll have at it. Well.
Mr. Chairman, you have another delegate back here, Captain Nordale.
Oh, yes, indeed. Nordale, would you care to make a remark?
Well, do I have to use microphone?
I don't know. Will it pick up?
Not very well.
I think it'd be appreciated if you would, because the...
Come on, Captain, you want to see it.
Oh, let's see. Remember what it was I was going to say. One thing that frightens me about this business is that it's opening a door that we had closed through because we were told it was very good judgment. We had information, the studies that we were given showed us states, for instance, the state of Michigan had only 17% of its revenues available for general fund appropriation. Someone mentioned this Texas education thing. That fund was astronomical, but there were many other things that were needed in the state of Texas, and they couldn't touch that sacred fund. And I think that once we do this, then somebody else is going to come in and say, well, let's have 25% of this money dedicated to education, or let's have 25% dedicated to some other purpose, and you're just blowing the authority of your legislature, who should, we're supposed to be able to trust them to handle the state money. What's to prevent the legislature itself, without a constitutional amendment, from setting up a permanent fund? That's their prerogative. They could even put 50% of it away for a while, but it wouldn't be fixed. If the time came, supposing we have another earthquake, maybe we'd need some extra money to take Anchorage out of the hole again.
How about Fairbanks?
Okay, I think that's all I want.
Thank you very much. Who'd like to be a proponent of the fund now and respond to or make any comments on what's said?
I would make this comment that we did. The legislature thought that we could do it through a bill, and that's the way we approached this to begin with. And Hugh Malone's original bill was a legislatively created permanent fund. The governor disagreed. He said it was unconstitutional and vetoed it. There's a lot to be said for a legislatively created fund because you can get out of it if you absolutely have to. On the other hand, there are always any number of people who say anything you can get out of the legislature's hands is good. Being a legislator, I don't necessarily subscribe to that notion. But I think there's a great deal to be said for the views that Mrs. Nordale has just expressed. But anyway, we didn't proceed in that way.
I think I'd also like to comment on it. The legislature, in its wisdom over the last few years, has created loan programs, and they put loan programs into an operating fund. And what we are doing are legitimatizing what the legislature has seen fit to have as programs in the state. Only it shouldn't be operated out of the one you pay your salaries with. It should be made out of a different sort of fund. And in fact, we have currently almost $200 million of a permanent fund already on our books. And it's in the way of veterans loan programs and other various types of loan programs that are dedicated for all intents and purposes, but if you had a crisis in Anchorage, you wouldn't be able to spend the money. It's already out in loan programs. It's a receivable.
I think that's an interesting point. I mean, which I think was well made. The money, the mortgage, is not readily translatable into cash. The veteran's mortgage or the small boat loan or whatever. Are there any comments on that?
You could sell those things. I know it was even being considered before we knew where we were going to get the money to balance the cash flow problem.
As you remember, what they were worth.
Well, yeah. Well, they're not worth 100 cents on the dollar, of course. But they are.
They're maybe worth 70 or.
Yeah. They are convertible.
Yes.
Any other panelists have any comments on the subject? Mr. White, we're talking about this earlier. Or here's somebody from the audience.
Can I just ask a question? Why isn't it worth anything?
Because the market rate of interest, if you'd have to sell them to another financial institution at a market rate of interest, and the loans weren't made at market rates of interest, they were made at somewhat less than market rate of interest.
But we are getting a return on them.
Yes, but it's not a market rate of interest. That's true. But, you know, in terms of market, if you sold it to a financial institution, it isn't worth that to a financial institution. They could make the loan themselves and get quite a bit more.
But is it worth it to the state of Alaska?
That's a moral judgment I can't make. But I'm saying in a time of financial crisis, if you were to sell them, you wouldn't have the... You would be appropriating money in effect by selling them.
The word subsidy is looked at with disfavor by a lot of people, but I think you'd have to say that the legislature, when it created the Veterans Loans Fund, created in fact a subsidy to those people. I think it's also true of small business loans that are made by the state. And whether it's good or bad, I'm not prepared to comment. I was not around when it was created. However, it is done frequently by every other government that exists, as far as I know.
Veterans subsidized 6 years of my life to the better, and I didn't get much return on that.
That's right. So it's all according to how you look at it.
This whole question, if we can bring this back into a sort of constitutional perspective, what about the perception of the delegates in 1955 of Alaska as it's constituted today? In other words, it's true the Constitution should not be lightly amended, and I think we've got, you know, a great document here. You'll see the constitutions of many other states back east and elsewhere. They may be 75, 150, 200 pages long. Ours is relatively brief. But anybody have any comments about what you saw at the time of writing the Constitution, Alaska's economic scene, and today's scene in terms of this permanent fund question? Mr. White or anyone of the delegates?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the numbers are certainly different from the time at which we were writing the Constitution and today. But I think that really constitutionally the point to be made here is that we cannot constitutionalize good government. And you cannot constitutionalize fiscal prudence. I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to answer your question any more interestingly than that. But in making comments in this area, I would like to play the role of an opponent of this proposed amendment to the Constitution and perhaps illustrate some issues that are worth thinking about and talking about both now and for the future. I think the people of Alaska generally have an idea that the legislature, not pointing a finger at any particular one, has gone overboard. We're worried. We're concerned when we see a flood of money coming into the state coffers, which may flow for only 20 or 30 years and then disappear if further oil discoveries aren't made. And we're all worried about what we do about it. Well, when you propose a giant savings account, opposing that is sort of like opposing brownie cookies. But I'm sure the legislature has done it's best to try to be responsible in looking at this problem and arriving at a workable solution. But I've had some problem with this myself, but I feel that dedicating funds in a constitution is bad government. Turning the coin over, I don't think it assures good government. I wonder a little bit about any legislature having done this and having let the people do it for them or with them. That might feel a little bit more free to be a little bit more less responsible with what's left over. We've established this marvelous savings account, and that takes care of fiscal prudence. Now we can really go overboard with what's left over. Don't worry about that a little bit. Think a little bit about the fund itself and who's going to manage it, how they're going to manage it. I'm told that it could well amount to $2 billion. Supposing an administration and legislature were mad at all the bankers in Alaska, this fund could be used to wipe out the bank and civil generation. That's an extreme example, but it can happen in some degree. Supposing you had an administration and a legislature which was violently no growth, on the face of this fund might be useful for growth. Might not all of it be invested in General Motors? That's a fiscally prudent investment. But it takes it out of the Alaska arena. Is the income for profit all that valuable to us? $2 billion at 7.5% interest is $150 million a year. Today we're spending $661 million a year. To achieve an income of that kind, is it worth it to take $2 billion permanently out of the, remove it from the Alaska scene? Because that's what we'd be doing. You take $2 billion derived from natural resources and permanently remove it from the spending stream, and there are a lot of other things you could have done. Backers of this amendment include among profit-making possibilities the wiping out of all our current debt. $500 or $600 million. I doubt it. I doubt it very seriously. But this would be a one-shot expenditure with one-shot funds that would be of benefit to all Alaskans. It would be a permanent benefit. It would be fiscally prudent. I think adoption of this amendment would reduce the possibility of that. It bothers me. But I suppose in the final analysis, if it's passed, you can say that that's $2 billion that can't be wasted.
On the other hand, though, Barry, we can waste it. There can be those jingoists around the provincialists in the state that say, we've got to spend it all in the state. And so they'll be searching for places to spend it, and there'll be unsound places to spend it. So it isn't quite so easy as that. We've got to be damn careful. And who are going to be the trustees that determine how we're going to divide up and spend that money? That I think is a crucial issue. Would you not agree?
I think we have somebody that wants to rehabilitate the concept for a minute here, Mr. Rose.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman,
please come to the microphone. Yeah.
Jim Rose. A number of times I've met this idea of using all or part of the permanent fund to retire the state's debt. And I don't think that passes economic muster. The state currently borrows at a rate of about 6.5%. But it can earn in the money markets at a rate of 7, 8, and at times with the North Slope account, 10% with premiums on treasury bills. So if you have an extra $100 million, let us say, you're much better off to invest it at 10% and go on paying debt at 6%, because you make the difference between 6 and 4. You lose money by retiring the state's debt.
Today?
Yes.
Not necessarily tomorrow.
Well, it's indefinitely true if I have $100 million. And the spread in the rates is, say, the difference between 10 and 6. It'll be true now, it'll be true 20 years from now.
Who wants to make a more general defense? Sterling, you have anything to say?
I say great wisdom setting aside the permanent funds. Let's talk about the permanent funds in the United States. There's $780 million in the Texas permanent fund. The uses of that money can only be the income. The principle is inviolate. The income off the fund can only be used to build buildings on the University of Texas and the Texas A&M campus. They have a very nice physical plant. It can't even be used for operating purposes in the University of Texas. One of the things that we have provided for in the permanent fund is that the income can be put to any use the legislature sees fit. There are 3 other permanent funds in the United States. They all come into existence in the last 3 years, and they're all in natural resource-oriented states. They're in the states of New Mexico, Montana, and Wyoming. I think the one in Montana comes from severance taxes. The one in Wyoming comes from royalties like ours does off coal lands. And the one in New Mexico comes from oil and gas. It's again, it's a matter of royalties and severance taxes in those states. What New Mexico has done with the funds, I'm not particularly enchanted with. They turn around and put them all the funds into the banks and let the banks make all the decisions. That may be, that's what we did with quite a bit of the money from the North Slope. We put it approximately $100 million into the state banking system, and maybe it was proper at that time with the banking system being short on funds. When I took office, 30% of the states, or the deposits in the state, were made up of state and local subdivision. I think it's now down around 15. What economic growth has done to the banking system is making them independent of the state government. I think it's a noble goal. I don't think it's fair to the banking system that they have to go out and raise huge amounts of capital, and they need the same capital ratios as other institutions outside for FDIC and other people to support huge amounts of money that we're going to put on their books. If on the other hand, we've created a weak financial institution because of it, where if we turned around and made the loans direct, we don't weaken their capital structure. Let me see. The state of Montana has used theirs to rehabilitate they put it into a fund, and the income off the fund is being used to rehabilitate the coal lands. It goes to make the coal land that is being used up in back into a productive resource, and I think that's a proper use of that, is to expand our economy and take the money from a non-renewable resource and make it renewable again in some sort of manner, or expand the fisheries. Wyoming has dedicated the money, I believe, to a better University of Wyoming, the income off the fund. That's the three sorts of permanent funds in the United States itself. Alberta has one, but they have what we know call is, you know, colloquially is soft loan programs and hard loan programs. The soft loan programs go into helping those really soft areas in the economy where we don't know the true economics, but nevertheless, they do expect to get a low rate of return, and they will recover the principal. In other parts, they use other parts of the money for what I call a hard loan. It's a regular business transaction, arm's length transaction. Let's say at a money market rate, let's say it could be used to support apartments. This if you look at a rural society, and of which Alaska falls into that class, you'll find that there's adequate money in the state or in the province or wherever for the normal commercial transaction. And if you go to a more mature economy, you'll find that the deposit structure in those economies have a lot more savings deposit that are a long-term sort of deposit. And what we would do with the permanent fund, what makes sense to do with the permanent fund is to invest it long-term in Alaska. It makes no sense whatsoever to invest it in the commercial banking field where there's adequate funds to do the job that at hand. I see the permanent fund as complementary to the banking system and not as competition at all.
Part of the thing, you can, at least to me, and I don't, people can disagree with the proposition, it makes such clear, ringing logical sense that if you've got something that is going to run out at some point, whether it be the year 2000 or 2010 or 2015, which is in fact translatable into dollars to you, what is the appropriate disposition of it? Is the appropriate disposition to spend it as it comes in so that at the point it runs out, there is indeed nothing left, bearing in mind that it's, at least to our current knowledge, the principal economic resource of the state? Does that make sense, or does it make better sense to somehow set a portion of it aside so that at the point when it does indeed fail, if it fails, something is left for future generations, where the wonderful aspect of money that it accumulates interest and the interest compounds, etc., etc. Now, that's, you know, to me that's the strongest part of the whole issue, but there's a real constitutional point here, and that is the people obviously are saying something about the legislature, and, you know, this is the institution of the government which we have historically given our affairs to on a full basis, and now we're saying yes, but not for this. That's the real point of interest to me, and I think it's when I hear the delegates say, you know, we looked at other states and we rejected it, I have to give that a lot of weight in the struggle with the precise issue 21 years ago and rejected it. Yeah, Jim.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I have a slightly different angle of on whether people are saying something about the legislature or really saying something about the state agencies. Historically, the legislature's budget has not varied from that submitted by a governor more than 2 percentage points, except one year in 1971, the very year that we came into the $900 million, the first budget year thereafter. And the fact is that the governor has access to the media. He's a single voice instead of a babble of 60. He has unity, that is, he can silence critics within his administration. He has access to most of the so-called experts. And there's a tremendous momentum, not on the part of the governor, but on the part of senior and middle-level civil servants who, not having a profit and loss statement, may well measure their success by how fast their agency is growing and how many new powers it has. And to make a personal statement in favor of the fund, as I once put it to a legislator, maybe if we don't throw all the meat in the cage, the monster's not going to get so big. And the budget has been growing at the compound rate of 26% a year. We have, I submit, a case of spending rising to meet revenues. In fact, it's been going up in round terms in multiples of 50. With the great advantages the executive has in making their case for budget growth, I think it's really a check upon ourselves, if not the legislature and the agencies. In the end, I suppose we bear the responsibility.
Jim, show me wanton waste? Can you show me evidences of wanton waste in those increases?
And I see there's a new question back here, which I'm very anxious to get. Excuse me. Would you mind stepping to the microphone? I know I had to do it this morning myself.
My name is Erin Van Bronckhorst. It seems to me that what he said contradicted what you said about state spending. Is that right?
Well,
is there any way to reconcile what you said? I mean, he said it went up 26% or something. And you said that figures show it didn't go up hardly at all.
There isn't conflict there. He's talking about in real terms. After you adjust for growth in population and rising prices, spending per capita in the last couple of years has leveled off. Now, there's two ways to explain that. One is that we've caught up with the backlog of unmet needs. Another explanation is that we were running out of money. And another explanation is that
rapid inflation,
and that the budget just seems to go up by multiples of 50 and 100 and 150 million in terms of just the psychology of the people that are involved in drawing budgets. And or you could put it another way.
I made a comment earlier about I think the legislature was satisfied when they went home, they satisfied their constituency because it went up by multiples of 50 million, even though the real change was zero. They went home saying that we met the end till late.
At the very least, you could say that we know that the public will tolerate level spending in real per capita terms, that is, after you take out the effects of population growth, new people to serve, and the effects of prices. We know from what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years that people will accept level public services. But that doesn't mean, I should think, that people wouldn't want more spent or wouldn't tolerate more being spent. In fact, there's the danger. Just, I'm making a personal statement. I'm not certain that more, I guess, a psychological statement from having observed not just the legislature, but how the agencies operate. 15,000 new people have been added to state and local government payroll since 1969, and they brought with them, on average, 3 to a family, another 45,000 people.
Well, my question really was, So you're using the argument that because the state budget goes up so much, you think the permanent fund should be approved.
Yes, it's to hold this money away from the agencies, or if you will, the legislature, various people.
Okay, so that doesn't
contradict
what he said.
No, it
doesn't.
Just a different light on it.
I think there's also another argument. There's a barrel of oil in the North Slope, and it's worth $9. But it's a one-shot deal. What we're doing is capturing that that equivalent dollar value as a legacy for the people, too.
Yeah, I understand that.
No, I'm not disagreeing with the point made by Mr. Wolfworth at all. I was just wanted to stress a point about, and also to raise the possibility that the momentum for the budget bureau came from the agencies, not the legislature.
Yeah, I think that answers my question.
Yeah. Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, I see some mystified faces out there, and I think it might be in order to explain that Jim Rode, who is sitting there, is the economist for the House Finance Committee, a full-time economist, and he has been in on the, from the inception, on the permanent fund, and so that he speaks with some background and authority on that. But that's just by way of explaining who Jim is.
Stan, I cut you off a moment ago. You had something. I hope you still have that.
No, it was just this fact that I think you got to dig, when you get to those points, the inference is that there's a lot of wanton waste in the bureaucracy. I've been a management analyst in the federal government for 20-some years, and I also participated in a small way in this businessman's team that recently went through this through the government. And a number of that same team, what they did was recruit, the professionals recruited businessmen who gave their full time to study where all this waste was in the state governments. And you know, they come up with a lot of savings, but actually when in Washington State and other states, after you take out their optimism and stuff, there isn't a lot of waste in the bureaucracy. If there is waste, nobody can pin it down. The waste are in small amounts here, there, and the other, everywhere, but in the aggregate, there is not waste in the bureaucracy.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make a comment, I agree with that. My point, rather, is do we need to be doing all the things we are doing, not so much is it being done with gross inefficiency?
All right, back when we had the $900 million and we were so optimistic about it, we thought it would last a long time. We failed to take into consideration the fact that the pipeline would be delayed, the fact that there would be this great inflation. But we did take into consideration the fact that there was going to be, that there was this great demand for social services. Now, we could have put that money in the bank and the social services would have suffered very badly. Roads, schools, health, you name it. Would we have had even a ferry system had we taken the $900 million and husbanded? So I don't think there was waste there. I think there were demands for social services. What concerns me is, of course, we get all this money that we invite people in, and then when the things stuff fold up, they're on our backs, and we have to take care of them. Do you agree with that, Jim?
Well, they leave. If everything collapses here, they'll leave.
Oh, but they don't leave, do they?
We've had population outflows at various times, especially in the serious recession after the Korean War and the Cold War construction boom in the state.
Did you have a comment on that, Steve?
Well, actually, I got up to shut the door, but...
I thought you were about to say something, too.
Well, And being a member of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, you know, we have got access to audits that are conducted periodically on various state agencies, and there are instances of abuse, and I'm sure there are in every sector, including the private sector. Anybody who can look at the pipeline as it's developed here in the last, three or four years, and say that waste is confined to the public sector, has just got one eye closed. You know, so it's going on, but The legislature is really concerned about waste within the bureaucracy. There's a great myth that the executive branch is trying to hold the legislature down. The legislature wants to go in and spend everything that there is, and the governor's, you know, holding on and everybody's straining. It ain't so. People can't wait to find some government agency that's squirreling away a few million bucks that they don't, that they shouldn't have. We've just discovered a little instance of that just recently, and the results will be interesting, I think. It's the Department of Health and Social Services, in case anybody's interested. But there is a public perception right now, sponsored by any number of people, that the legislature is wasteful, is that they shouldn't be entrusted with anything, let alone the public funds. And it's just one of those things that's probably cyclical, and that we have to deal with it. But I'm sure that that is going to be one of the main reasons that people vote for the public, for the permanent fund. We ought not to give those clowns any authority at all. I mean, that's exactly the way people think right now. And
those clowns are exactly the same people that you, me, everyone else. If we're not down there, we're voting for them. Yes.
Could I ask Mr. Calvert a question?
Yes, sir.
If I were in the legislature today, I'd be very much for this permanent fund because I believe in saving money for a rainy day. On the other hand, I'm dead set against making amendments to the Constitution unless it's absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. And if it came down to the nitty-gritty, that was the only method to save this money, I might even vote for the amendment, but I certainly hate to do it. Now, I'd like to ask you, what other methods were explored to set some of this money aside? And were there any that seemed good to you or practical?
Well, of course, initially, the permanent fund concept, as I mentioned before, was by legislative enactment and not constitutional law.
Yeah, yeah.
And we thought that it would... And the big criticism at that point was, well, it's all phony, you know. The legislature sets up its fund, but you can just come back next year and spend all of it. And that, you know, that's the kind of bombs we were getting at that time. Of course, that's true, presumably, but my answer to that was that the permanent fund, even though it's set up by statute and not by constitutional amendment, is so up there in the public eye that I think any politician that said, well, let's bust into that permanent fund and carry off 50 million bucks, the public would be right down his throat. I think there's a built-in pressure against that kind of activity.
Was but there any other method other than establishing a permanent fund? For instance, give somebody a Department of Finance responsibility for investing all money income that was not appropriated this year, or